As we finished our last interview, we were talking about the liturgy. What does it do to the laity when the liturgy that is being conducted in all the parishes is constantly changing?
It does this. It does precisely whatever recurring change does to a human being. We all find, Bernard, in our normal lives, that we always have a basic routine we go through every day. And within that routine, we can have variations. But there's no routine, there's no change in the basic routine. Otherwise, we don't know ourselves any longer. Our children don't know us. We don't know, nobody can find us. Life is in constant change. It's what happens during wartime. And I remember during the Second World War, it was the dreadful devastation when the houses were bombed and streets, cities were bombed. People couldn't find themselves any longer. They had no routine in life. Similarly with prayer, if the way I pray to God and the gestures I use and the words I use are constantly changed, and really changed. There's constant change. If that goes on long enough, I become confused. Because we depend on routine, basic routine. Children do, human beings do, adults do, married people do, everybody does. And there's a continual change which is deliberate, and that's meant to constantly keep us moving away from the fundamentals of Catholicism into new territory. One of the latest territories, for instance, is Enneagrams. And this is a new system of deciding what sort of a person you are. And you, when you've completed the course, which is now given by Jesuits and Franciscans in parishes, instead of Stations of the Cross, instead of retreats, instead of missions, you're given four initials to put after your name describing your character. And that will tell you who to marry and how to behave and what your passions are and what your weaknesses are and your strengths are. This is all psychological profiling. And that's instead of now the sermon on, say, the Ten Commandments, or sermons on the Six Commandments of the Church, or on the doctrines of the Church. So that that will change for another fad next year, as worked out by some other psychologist. And so this changes continuously, and then they have various canons of the Mass and various new prayers and various ways of doing things. And anyway, the Novus Ordo itself allows great ingenuity. Literally, you can say the Novus Ordo, the Mass, the present moment, in shorts. In Bermuda shorts with a sweater on you. There's no demand on anything. And the variations are huge. So that this change in, this constant change and the lack of routine, lack of the same songs to sing, produces destruction of belief. For instance, if the national anthem was changed every 4 or 5 years, do you think people would finally ever sing it? Would have any idea of their country? National anthem is supposed to honor the country itself. You repeat the same words, and everybody knows them, and they have a long memory, and they recall everything in the past, and that retains the memory of what we are.
They lose a sense of what the country stands for.
That's right. That's right. It doesn't stand for anything. It obviously is always changing. And similarly with the flag, there are certain things that must remain. But the network of our counter-plotters, the people out to destroy the Roman Catholic Church, have adopted an attitude of constantly confusing and removing people from any solid memory of anything permanent in religion, because they want to remove that. See, the strength of the church always was that it was a permanent rock, using the same ceremonies, repeating the same commandments, giving the same rules for life, always adapting them to the age in which they were. That was the strength of it all. And that now is being undermined completely and changed. And the idea is to confuse people so that they need direction from outside directors. And that's where the shadow of Big Brother comes in. Big Brother telling you what to think, what to feel, how to get married, how many children to have, and how to have them, and how to pray, and how to settle your life.
Now, in the United States last year, there was an attempt to change the Grail Psalter and the Sacramentary. Mm-hmm. That was blocked.
It was blocked. Finally, they began to realize, the mass of the bishops and priests began to realize that there was a sinister move in this. So they blocked it. They blocked it or stopped. But it will start again. The initiative will come up in another way.
Well, this is one reason why the altar girl decision maybe surprised some people, is because here, they had blocked a change. They thought, okay, now we've finally brought stability to the conciliar church.
And stopped the change.
Right. And then this other change opened up over here.
Sure. And then on top of all that, now I was talking with a young priest a few weeks ago, and he was telling me about this new parish system where the parish priest is eliminated and you have this new pastoral leader idea. The plans are infinite, and they will keep on because they are intent on changing things. They're intent on destroying the structure of the church as it is. And you see, Bernard, that's a point which we've made before, and we must make again, is this. If you looked at the church in 1960 or 1961 or 1950, the structure was very simple, really. You had Rome, the central hub, and out from that there ran lines of communication, pipes, if you wish, out from the central hub. And through those pipes flowed from Rome instructions and commands and decrees and books and doctrine from the Holy Father and from his various ministries. And through the pipes' backs came obedience and zeal and contributions and saints and mission efforts and etc., etc., etc. Vatican II changed that structure. It created in each country at least one new hub, which has its own life. It is no longer dependent on Rome for anything. Not really. It acts independently. It has its own series of committees, bishops' conferences, priest conferences, nuns' conferences, priest senates, national organization of women, of Catholic women, national organization of nuns, national organizations of priests, of monsignoria, of bishops, of archbishops.
Well, it's become also complicated with all these committees and subcommittees.
Everything is a committee. When anything has to be done in a parish or a diocese, the bishop forms a committee. He forms a new committee of laymen and some nuns and some priests. So you have now all over the world these regional hubs, and the Pope's hub is only one hub. And they don't function together at all. And Rome itself is isolated, and now it has been penetrated, and therefore that it no longer is the directive, the source of direction. And the Pope is only one voice in many voices.
So the Pope doesn't know everything that even goes on in Rome?
He can't know. He can't. In Rome itself, he can't. If you see, the difficulty with people talking about Roman Catholicism and the Pope, and how the Pope doesn't do this and he should do that. If you lived in Rome and worked there, you'd know that you're in the middle of a rabbit warren. A honeycombed hill. There are committees and groupings and consultancies and ministries and missions that the Pope doesn't even know about. He doesn't even know about them, much less know the personnel. He doesn't know them. He can't get around them. If he went to each one of them once in a year, he wouldn't cover them all. And then the rest of the church would be going to hell at the same time in a handbasket because he wouldn't give him any attention to attend to any of them. And the men serving in these various places, the heads, the cardinal prefects, as they call them, of the congregations, most of them dislike this Pope intensely. I suppose there are about barely five cardinals, count them on one hand, who would support him at a pinch. The rest are very independent-minded. And for instance, you take an old cardinal like Cardinal Chappie or Cardinal Oddi, their whole purpose in life is to be let live in the Vatican. They've retired. They don't want to go out to the Campagna or retire to Florence or to their birthplace or to their parents or their nephews and nieces or live in an old man's home. They want to have their apartment in the Vatican. And they know that doesn't depend on the present Pope because he's going to die. So they must please the crowd in power. And the crowd in power do not like the present Pope.
Now let's take a look at another situation that happened that involved Rome and see if that illustrates a point. Recently in the Diocese of Chur in Switzerland,
that's right,
there they appointed a conservative bishop to clean up what had been
that's
a
right.
very messy situation
that's
there.
Right.
There was a protest. Then they appointed two auxiliaries that were liberals to frustrate him.
That's right.
Is there a war going on in Rome? Does that show that there's two factions nullifying each other?
No, there's one faction against the Pope, one major faction against the Pope. And you see, the difficulty is this. Most people think the Pope appoints bishops. He doesn't appoint bishops. Because he is one of five or six signatures on the final document that says that Bernard Jansen will be appointed Bishop of Zurich. He's only one of five. If he signs it, sometimes he doesn't even know it until it's announced. He doesn't know. He's not a hands-on man, number one. He's not a hands-on man, a hands-on governor of things. Governing is not his forte. But even the things he should know, he doesn't know. But there's too much. How can he deal with, for instance, the appointments in Madagascar? He doesn't know Madagascar. He doesn't know the appointments that should be made in Kerry Island or in Nebraska in the USA. He doesn't know anything about it. He hasn't got time to get around to all the dioceses. And he doesn't know the bishops. And they come. We have bishops here who go to see him for their ad limina visit, the five-yearly visit that a bishop must pay to the Pope. And they give him a glowing picture of everything. Then they go home and do the very opposite. What is he to do? What is he to do? Call them back and say, you're a liar?
Well, in Canada, we had a very strange situation where there was a theologian who signed a paper which denounced the latest encyclical, The Splendor of Truth.
Wow.
And now this theologian has now been raised to the level of a diocesan bishop.
That's right. Well, he's put in by the people who dislike John Paul II completely and who have the power to appoint a bishop. And they're all over the place. We have a bishop up here, an auxiliary bishop in Syracuse, in New York, who continually keeps on saying that the church of the future will not have a pope or a bishop or a priest. And he's still an auxiliary bishop because he's protected by the network. So there is a war between the hubs. All the hubs are fighting Rome and don't want any interference. I remember when the question of in vitro fertilization arose a couple of years ago, 8, 10 years ago, I was called by somebody in Canada about it. And I said, well, have you consulted Rome? And they went ballistic on the phone. They said, we don't go to Rome for these things. We're independent. They wouldn't consult the Holy Office or consult Cardinal Ratzinger, the head moralist in the church. They were independent. I suddenly realized, my God, they regard themselves as totally independent of Rome. And they do. And fight Rome on every issue. And Rome has ceased to have any power. It has the power theoretically, but not practically, because they themselves are against the papacy. They no longer want an absolute papacy. The absolute control of the Pope who can say yes or no. They don't want that any longer. And John Paul II has aided that, and so has Pope Paul VI, by the way they behaved in John the 23rd. Remember, the most fatuous statement of the modern church was made by John the 23rd in his opening speech on October 11, 1962. He said, our mother, the church, once upon a time, used penalties to punish those who violated her laws. Now we know, and listen to the fatuous statement of a pope, a reigning pope, now we know that once men are told the truth and recognize it, that they obey willingly. Was there anything so stupid pastorally?
Well, can you imagine?
So off the mark papally, so ridiculous as that.
Well, can you imagine what would happen, let's say, in my family if I told my children,
do what you like.
But no matter what you do, you're not going to be punished. I trust that you'll always do the right thing.
That's right.
There would be chaos.
That's what happens in American schools. They're not punished. And that's what criminals over here, they know they're out in the street 24 hours later, having mugged somebody. Punishment. But this fatuous statement of John 23 has been driven like a coach and four through everything. And hence, we had a very funny incident in Rome, and I must tell you what it was like. The librarian of the Gregorian University in my time found out that the volume after volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica were disappearing. And it's a very expensive thing. So they set up a watching machine, and they caught the man. He was a young student from, I think it was America or Italy. I don't know where he was from. I forget the details. And they confronted him and went to his room, and they found all the missing volumes. And you know what he said to them? He said, okay, far ahead. Now apply the law. Punish me if you want to. But it was nothing moral about it. It was just the machinery happened to go against him. It's a funny thing. Once you abdicate punishment, once you think that you can get away with it, you have no respect for the law. Now, there is no longer any respect for Rome. Rome can't punish anyone. Who is Rome going to punish in the name of God? How can it punish a bishop? How can it punish Richard McBrien? How can it punish Charlie Curran? He's supported by his own bishop. They all have good standing, and most of them are heretics.
And there's so many to punish.
It's gone. And it reinforces the one fact I've kept saying to you, but not in these conversations. The Pope saw it was over in 1978. He saw it. And he said, I'm not going to waste my efforts at doing this because I can't do it. It can't be done. God has subtracted grace. He's withdrawn his protection from this visible organization. It is cursed by God. It is going out of existence. I'm going to do something else. That's his attitude to life.
Now, here's another very confusing situation that I hope you can shed some light on. In the United States last year, there was an appeal to Rome from six faithful Catholics who had been supposedly excommunicated.
In Honolulu.
Right. And they won their appeal. And there was an order that said that the whole thing was null and void.
That's right.
Now I pick up the newspapers and hear that an interdict might be applied to them. What's going on?
This is the scam behavior of the present Roman administration. The villain of the piece in this was a man called Cacciavillan, who is the Pope's personal representative, the apostolic delegate in Washington, who is a great pal of Bishop Ferrario of Honolulu. And Bishop Ferrario of Honolulu is a very distinguished man in the sense that he's been sued by homosexuals and sued for homosexuality. Nothing ever proven. Now, he excommunicated six people, all of whom are excellent Catholics, who continually attacked him for the way he was dealing with churches and for his tolerance of homosexuality. And he excommunicated them all six of them. They did appeal to Rome. Rome examined it and said, this is a complete scam. These people are carrying out the law of the church. The bishop is not. And therefore, there was no excommunication. They are Catholics in very good standing. They sent this message, as they usually do, through the apostolic delegate in America, in Washington, Monsignor Cacciavillan, Archbishop Cacciavillan. He took the letter and added himself the following to Bishop Ferrario, the villain of the piece. He said, you can put them under interdict for insolence or for not respecting your word and for attacking you. And he sent out this as Rome's answer. He pretended that this is the message he got from Rome. Until people went to Rome and said, did you say this? Did you say that they were to be put under interdict? You know, interdict, by the way, for our listeners, means that you can't go to Mass, you can't hear confession, you can't have your confession heard, you can't have a baptism done, you can't be married. It means you're forbidden all the services of the church until you come back to the fold. And Rome never said that. But Cacciavillan added it in order to save the face of Ferrario. And this is the usual villainy that Roman officials practice. And Cacciavillan should hide his head in shame.
Now, what is the authentic role of an apostolic delegate or a papal nuncio? What do they do?
He's the representative of the Pope to the state, primarily, and then to the bishops. Anybody can call the apostolic delegate. Don't call this man. But in theory, anybody can call or send him a letter complaining about things, about the religion or about bishops or about priests or about anything at all. He's the Pope's representative. And there are about 85 of them, almost 100 of them throughout the world. And they're politicians, they're diplomats, and they have a shortwave radio. They're in constant communication with Rome. During the war, it was one of the great ways of communicating through the apostolic delegates. And during the war in Iraq, this was the same thing. We had a man in Baghdad, a very good man, a Polish prelate, who could communicate with the Pope and tell him what was going on there.
Now, I know of some situations in Canada where the faithful have seen terrible abuses going on in their parishes and written to the papal nuncio, and nothing happens.
Well, the papal nuncio in Canada and the apostolic delegate here, the Pope's representative here and in Canada and in most places, in Haiti, for instance, are a disgrace. A disgrace. Because listen to their reasoning. It's very simple. A man like Cacciavillan says, well, I'm younger than this Pope. I'm going to be alive when he's dead. And if I'm not on the side of those who make the next Pope, or one of whom is going to be the next Pope, I'm going to be out of favor. So they're looking to their own benefit. Besides, there's the grim, horrid truth that faith has diminished amongst the clergy. We now have the spectacle of bishops and priests and cardinals whom we know in their intimate lives don't believe a damn thing, but are not going to quit their job, because what are they going to do? And why should they quit membership in a gilt-edged club which assures them dignity, stature, privilege, money, and a lifestyle which how they afford otherwise?
But isn't it the faith that is the glue that holds the whole church together, which explains then why at odds with itself now.
That's why the Pope said the glue is gone, the cement is gone, the building is in shambles already. Already by 1978, remember, the church was in shambles. At the end of the reign of Paul VI, he was in for 15 horrid years, and he successfully dismantled the church. And he himself, in his misery at the end, mumbled words like, "The smoke of Satan has entered the church. And we will finally end up, we Catholics, as a fragmented remnant on the fringe of society." Imagine a pope saying that. There's no strength in that. There's no courage in that. There's no belief in that. There's just the misery of a man guilty of one of the greatest crimes in the history of the papacy.
Now, when we're talking about the disbelief that's going on in the church, how does one explain, let's say, a prelate like Los Angeles' Roger Mahoney, who undermines the efforts of good laity to fight against abortion and homosexuality?
Faith. Faith. Bernard, at the back of it all, there's faith. If you lose your faith... You see, let's talk about faith for the moment. Most people look on faith as a gift, and it is a gift. And they look on it like, if I give you a gift for your birthday, it's a fountain pen, or it's a wallet, or it's a tie, or something else like that. They look on it as an object. Faith is not an object. It's not something you put in your pocket, in your soul. It is a dimension of being. And we all know from the experience of life, we're sufficiently adult to know, that your being, your vitality, your vitalism, your physical vitalism, wanes and waxes, grows and diminishes with your health, with your age, with your diseases, with the oppression on you, with labor on you. It varies. It is a dimensional thing. Similarly with faith. I can, for instance, believe most of the things given to faith, but I do not believe in avoiding contraception, because we have two children, we don't need any more. This is a hypothetical case. And therefore, I diminish my faith by that amount. But that affects other things, finally. It erodes my faith. But then my faith diminishes, and I can finally end up believing very little, except that I should be a Catholic, a practicing Catholic, but I'm not. And there are many Catholics like that today, because they're divorced, because they contracept, because they have killed off some of their children to an abortionist, because they become Freemasons, because they masturbate, because they're bisexual, and they know this all wrong, but they can't get out of it. But their faith is diminished, because if your faith is diminished to such a point, you don't have it. Now, there's a point about faith which we must insist upon with everybody, that they know it. If you lose your faith, you don't know you've lost it. Bernard, if you take a man, cultured man, and you reduce him to barbarity, and they know how to do that nowadays. The Nazis were able to do it. The Stalinists were able to do it in the Gulag. He doesn't know he's been barbarized. He doesn't know he's been reduced in his culture. Similarly with belief. If you lose your belief, you don't know you've lost your belief. Otherwise, you'd run like hell to get back and get it. You don't know you've lost it. You think that you're okay. You think that the other guy who undertakes these labors because of faith is stupid. Why have more babies if you can avoid them? Don't be so stupid about it all. Because he's lost his faith. You don't know you've lost your faith. The penalty for losing your faith, which you always lose deliberately, is that you don't know. And you can't get it back by saying, okay, now I'll return to the church. Oh, no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work like that.
So there's a certain blindness in all of this.
Completely. You don't know. You don't know. And you look at the other guy who's observing the law and observing his Catholic ways. You say, what a bloody fool he is. He hasn't grown up. It's like the famous phrase of Lord Palmerston. Any man over 50 who believes in God must be a jackass. He committed suicide, by the way. But it's this blindness. If you don't know it, so don't appeal to somebody who's lost his faith and say to him, well, you shouldn't do that. He thinks you're a fool. He doesn't know. He's lost his faith. And you don't get it back, by the way. You don't get it back easily. This is the terrible thing once you throw that pearl of great price away. You will not get it back easily. You may never get it back. You may simply go straight to hell when you die.
This opens up a very serious question. Suppose there is a prelate, a bishop in some diocese, or a theologian teaching in a Catholic university who has lost his faith. Mm-hmm. Do they still hold their offices?
They should not. But nowadays we have them all over the place. We have them in Catholic University of Washington. We people who deny the divinity of Christ teaching there. Priests. Not prelates, they're priests. We have prelates who don't believe these things any longer. We know they don't believe it, but they're still maintained as bishops. Why? Because superiors in Rome have lost their faith and get paid by him or are in the same network of homosexuality or are just pals with him. So they support each other. But of course they should be fired immediately. They shouldn't be tolerated. And there should be watchdogs to make sure we know if a person is a believer or not. There was in the old church. But since that fatuous statement of John the 23rd, we now trust people, which is the most ridiculous thing going. We don't trust ourselves. Why should we trust anybody else? We must be supervised. And when people do deviate, then they should be called in on the mat and said, you have deviated. And either you correct your behavior, pray for your faith, get back to it, or you leave. There must be. But that's the new conciliar church. Everything is allowed.
But that's a situation then in which the average layperson is going to have to make a decision on their own.
Absolutely.
Whether or not to follow this particular theologian.
Absolutely.
They can't rely on the Rome that out for them.
No, you can't. Nowadays, you cannot go to the parish priest or to the bishop or to Rome and say, what should I do? They won't tell you. They don't know. Or they're already heretical and they're going to give you the opposite, bad advice. They're going to give you the opposite of what advice to what you should get. That's the unfortunate thing about it. And Bernard, you see, that's the difficulty of the layman or laywoman today who have children and who have to rear them, and for themselves too. They have got to educate themselves all by themselves. Nowadays, there is a new movement amongst Catholics, though. They're now beginning to print catechisms and have special groups apart from priests and apart from the church to educate each other and to educate themselves. And I participate in several of those here in New York and in Boston and in Philadelphia. I direct several score of those groups of people. Now that they're reading, they're buying books, they're searching back for books that are out of print. They're reprinting books and educating themselves, because they say, we're not going to be educated by the churchmen, and we will finally be without the churchmen.
Is there a reason perhaps why God has put families in this situation where they have to rely upon themselves?
I don't know the mind of God except in what he does. And Bernard, apparently Christ has made a very radical decision about our age. And the radical decision is apparently a very harsh one. Once upon a time, when I was very young, you could be blasé about certain things because there were safety nets everywhere. Your parents, the community, the cops even, the teachers, the social workers.
You could rely on them to correct you if you went off the rails.
You were caught. There were safety nets. Now there are no safety nets at all. Christ hasn't done that. And he will not put up for one moment with any misbehavior. He won't stand impurity in your life. He won't stand dishonesty. He won't stand infidelity. And if you say on a Sunday, well, I'm too tired and the wife and the children are too tired, and we will skip Mass because we've all been working very hard during the week and God will understand. It's very difficult to do that in the beginning. Do it four or five times and it's very simple. And Christ's decision is he will now not give you the means of getting back. Nobody will reproach you. In fact, you'll find everybody says, okay, you're right, take it easy. Life is difficult enough already. The taxes are high and you work like a dog. So he won't make it easy for you any longer. And he, once in a while, he'll pass by you. He passes by every human being and looks at them like at the rich young man. And either you say, yes, I'll follow and be faithful in spite of everything, or you won't. And he won't come back. He won't come back. He will leave you sink into your unfaith and into your sins. And that is apparently the decision he's made about churchmen and churchwomen, nuns and priests and bishops. Now they've given into this and that and the other. He will leave them there. He doesn't any longer send them.
So he doesn't step in to save people from themselves.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. This is his radical decision about today. Do you know why? I think, it's my guess is this, that it's now you can find out the truth if you want to. You have a means of communication. You can travel. You can find out. You can talk to people. You can read books. You can find out what you should do if you want to. We're no longer isolated. We're now a globalized, mediated world. You have plenty of means of educating yourself. Don't blame anybody else. And if you've been going to the Novus Ordo and got nothing out of it for so long, and no longer believe in the real presence, and no longer say your rosary, and no longer pray at night, you never get down in your hunkers in the morning or at night, and you don't rear your children well, you don't teach them morality, who are you going to blame?
You have been speaking about learning your faith through various means, such as catechisms. And this leads us to a subject which, again, is somewhat confusing. There has been a new catechism that has been recently promulgated by Rome. Why has the English-speaking version of this catechism been delayed so long?
The whole question of the Universal Catechism of the Church, I think they call it's called officially the Catechism of the Catholic Church, is a perfect example of the corruption in the church. The corruption in the teaching church, the corruption in the clergy, the corruption in the academic church, the corruption in the priestly church, the corruption in the bishops, in the hierarchical church, and the corruption, above all, in the overall administration of the Church Universal. Let me tell you a few home truths about it, what has really happened. The original idea of the Universal Catechism has arisen because there have been so many bad local catechisms, like the Dutch Catechism, which has never been corrected. It is un-Catholic. And by the elimination of old catechisms like the Baltimore Catechism or the Penny Catechism, as they call it, which were excellent, but which were eliminated during the reign of Paul VI by those who didn't want people to know their faith. They wanted a new doctrine. Okay. So the present Pope made up his mind that there should be a general catechism which could be edited for various places, but a general catechism containing the basic truths of Christianity. And he did that for a very good reason, because he could see from his catbird seat, from his central position, that slowly but surely the teaching of faith was failing. And that book recently published in Canada by James Demers, The Children of Winter, I think it's called, outlines how the hierarchy of North America, the USA and Canada, literally threw one whole generation to the dogs, didn't educate them at all in their Catholic faith. So the Pope said, well, we should have a universal catechism available to everybody in which they can find the true faith. Okay. So he set about mandating that to be done. And a synod of the church, I think, also voted it should be done. And they set up committees to do that and scholars to draw it up. But after that, as Napoleon said, it was the deluge, you know, après-mort c'est le deluge. Because if this went through as it was planned, there would be a perfectly clear enunciation of Catholic doctrine in its traditional form. None of the modern garbage. None of all the horizontal churches, piffle and nonsense. It would be as basic a document as the Catechism of the Council of Trent, which we all use today still. The Catechism of the Council of Trent simply states the doctrine of the church, period, nothing else. So the enemies of the church set out to destroy it. And the moment any texts were produced by the scholars preparing the text, they were attacked. And then several books came out in English, in French, and in German, and in Spanish and Italian, attacking the whole idea and attacking the already proposed texts of the new catechism. And we had one book published here by the Jesuits in the United States, attacking the whole idea as well as attacking the proposed texts. But eventually, a text was set up. But then something happened along the way, you know, as they say, something happened on the way to the forum. Something happened, for instance, we find that the ultimate text is not in Latin. Every Roman text is in Latin. It was in French. And French is one of the most ambiguous languages going. And number two, then, the text was delayed, and delayed continually, because once sample texts were sent out to the bishops, the request came back that they should have what they call inclusive language. That is, they should purge the catechism of any reference to he or his or him and make it universal to apply to men and women. That's called the inclusion, that's inclusive language. Exclusive language is where I say, well, we're all the sons of God. And people would say, well, what about the daughters of God? But this was the issue at stake. And they wanted to change the quotations from the New Testament and the Old Testament and make them inclusive. So that they'd have to say, they'd try and avoid the word Father, our Father, who art in heaven. They try and avoid the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, because those are exclusive. And there were tremendous rows and disputes and lies and false texts about this. And finally, and it was disgraceful in the matter of the American, the English version published in the United States, because Cardinal Law was found to be defending inclusive language for a lot of the new catechism. And he delayed the Bible. He delayed the publication of this catechism. Now apparently they've all agreed on a certain amount of inclusive language and a certain amount of exclusive language. And the result, well, the result is a potpourri. There's no doubt about it, Bernard. In this catechism, you can find every basic truth of the Catholic Church enunciated, one way or the other. It's all there. And the moment I got my copy of it in French, that was the first text published. That's the official text, by the way. I went through with a red pen, and I underlined everything that was traditional, everything that Gregory the Great would have admitted, that Pope Damasus in the 5th century would have admitted, that Pope Leo in the 4th century would have admitted, that Pope Innocent III, and Pope Gregory the 14th, and Pius the 12th, and Pius the 11th, and Leo the 13th, that would have admitted as faith, part of the faith. I underline that. And by the way, once you do that, and look then at what all the pages, and there are over 1,000 pages in the New Catechism, you find out that, what's the other stuff doing there? And what's the other stuff? Oh, the other stuff is absolutely dizzying. For instance, the part of the catechism deals with homosexuals tells us we must welcome homosexuals. Accueillir is the French for our Canadian listeners. What does welcoming homosexuals mean? It also says that some of them are not responsible for their condition and thereby partakes in a wild theory that some people are born by nature homosexual, which is a disputed theory even by scientists who have nothing to do with religion. And there's a lot of other garbage about it. And so on for everything, there's a lot of garbage. But in addition to that, there's a lot of other stuff which is unacceptable for Catholics. The attitude to the Jews who killed Jesus. The relation between Judaism and Christianity. Almost goes to the point of saying that Judaism is as valid a way of life as Christianity is. And the dealing with Christ. And then the idea of punishment, the idea of hell. They're all mitigated. The doctrines are put there, and then they're mitigated by ambiguous language. In other words, the same hand. You remember when they tried to deceive old Isaac, and he said, "Well, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hand is the hand of Esau." You can see the same hand that produced the texts in Vatican II, the ambiguous texts, which have driven a coach and four through Catholic doctrine. You can see the same fine hand at work in the Catechism. So that you have to have somebody to interpret the catechism and say, well, this section is fine, but this thing here is non-Catholic. And on capital points, the personality of Jesus, the relationship of the Church to our Lord, the Blessed Sacrament, on salvation, on the unicity of Christian salvation in the Church as distinct from all other churches, the relationship of Jews to God, the relationship of Judaism to Christianity, the last things, the last days, the entire structure is affected by this ambiguity. So is it a good catechism? No. Is it a bad catechism? No. It needs to be dealt with great care, like the Novus Ordo. Again, it's the same fine hand creating ambiguity and destroying the clarity of my faith, which was perfectly clear in the Baltimore Catechism and the Penny Catechism and all the other little catechism. Not in this document. It's meant to confuse and is meant to make things easy for people, whereas Christianity is a bleak message. It means correct your passions, cleanse yourself perpetually, and before you die, get absolution for your sins and repent, because if you don't, you're going to go to hell.
How does it deal with the dogma outside the church there is no salvation?
It doesn't. It doesn't. It does it in such a confused way that finally being a good Presbyterian is just as good as being a good Catholic, or being a good Jew is just as good. It's not clear. It's not clear. If you read the Catechism of the Council of Trent, it's absolutely clear. You may not like it, but you know what they're saying. And they were drawn up by Jesuits. That was drawn up by Jesuits at the Council of Trent itself. And as you know, I had a hard time there. Didn't want to publish it. The enemies of the church saw clearly that once you have a thing like that, there's no compromise. With the New Catechism, you can read it if you have the patience to go through thousands of pages and mark it carefully. You can read it, but then somebody must know their faith beforehand. You won't learn the faith from it. You'll be confused. That's the unfortunate thing about it. So it's a spent force. And anyway, you know, Bernard, there's something else which should be remarked here. We are not a generation who reads. We're not a reading generation. We're not a listening generation. We are a looking generation. We look. We want images. This is what we listen. It's the last. We listen to a certain degree. But even we've now listening powers are dying down. We're now looking general. We want the image. And that's why this new information highway they have now, the combination of TV and radio and telephone and everything they put into one, is going to have such success. Because now we want to be given the image. And we're imageful. We're seeing, essentially a seeing generation now. You cannot become a doctor by looking at pictures, not going to a lecture. You can see every operation done and be instructed on it. We're seeing more than the idea of putting a huge volume of 1,000 pages in the hands of any Catholic throughout the world, whether they're living in Rwanda, Burundi, or Tasmania, or Dublin, Ireland, or Tokyo, or Glasgow, Scotland, or New York. Most of them can't read. They don't read.
This leads now to a very interesting question. What, let's say, has radio and television and some of these modern means of communications done to man? What is it like now to live in a civilization where most people don't read? What effect has it had?
I'll tell you, it's a dire effect. And people are beginning to realize it too. The effect is this. Bernard, in essence, you and I and all Catholics, and I suppose all Christians who are believers still, we claim that a message has been transmitted to us from beyond the stars, from beyond the cosmos, from beyond the material cosmos. And this message has come from the supernatural, where there's neither form, nor shape, nor smell, nor color, nor size. That it's transcendent being. And this message came in the form of a baby who grew up to be a man and proved he was the Son of God and died and rose again and then returned to heaven in his essence and who founded a church. But his message is transcendent and it's without form. And we, the entire history of Christianity, we have had great difficulty in formulating this. And in the first few centuries, we had to formulate, what do we mean when we say he's God? What do we mean when he says man? Had he a real mother? Was it all a fake? And then when we say that he's in the Blessed Sacrament, that he's really present in the tabernacle, what do we mean by that? The entire Middle Ages were contorted with the fights of that, and Thomas Aquinas finally categorized and catalogued that doctrine for us. And then we went into other problems, but we spent a long time defining in human terms this supernatural, formless message about the Trinity. And the central message of the message was very simple. It was this, that when you die, when your body corrupts, you are destined either to go and worship that being, the life of the Trinity, or to perish in hell. Now, that's all in words. We have words and we have phrases and concepts and catechisms and doctrines and books and speeches to tell us about this. But in essence, it's without image. Anything, therefore, that makes it impossible for us to believe in something without form or shape, anything supernatural, is going to undermine our faith. If for something to be real for us, it must be seeable, touchable, visible, smellable, eatable, have dimensions. If that is the limits of our reality, then we're weaned away, we're alienated to the supernatural, alienated to this message. We no longer belong to it, and we're condemned to hell. Every means we have today, especially the new information highway, this combination of computer networks and my telephone and my TV screen and my radio, ties me to pixels, ties me to strokes and knots, ties me to a way of thinking about everything which is crass and material, doesn't allow me picture the idea or entertain the concept of the Word of God made man, and to by analogy, reach an understanding of his being. Of what I will be when I join the Trinity. I lose my sense of faith because I am depending on an image and I have no image of that. I can't have an image of it. Whereas we are built on images. And that's our civilization has done that to us. And the church hasn't even begun to think. The churchmen had not even begun to imagine how they're going to transmit the message about the Word made flesh. They haven't begun to think about it because academically the church is dead. And pedagogically, the church is dead. There is no school of philosophy alive today. There's no school of theology alive today.
So really now what has happened is that man has lost the vertical dimension.
That's right. And above all, the church teachers have lost it. They've lost it. And that's why you find them going to phenomenology. And the present Pope, one of his errors is the nourishment of phenomenology, especially this academic institution in Liechtenstein, which he...
What is phenomenology?
Phenomenology is roughly, it's a philosophy which says, look, let's not examine, as the ancient philosophers did, the being of the cup or the table or your being and my being. Let's concentrate on the relationship between them and discover what is reality from the relationship. And it's away from essentialism, and it's an attempt to stand between the idealism of the idealist school, Kant and Heidegger and the others, mainly Kant though, and Schiller and the philosophers who were what they call idealists, who said it's all an idea, it's not real at all, and the realists, which are the medievalists. It's an attempt to be in the middle of the relationship of it's a relationship study. And therefore it goes into psychology and psychology of personality and the acting person, as the Pope calls it. And it's away from Thomism. It's not the solid doctrine which teaches, which facilitates the teaching of the Church. Now, with that, your faith is diminished. You no longer are concentrating. You have no longer got the means of concentrating on a transcendent truth which has no form. And you're delivered to images. You must have images. You must have words and images. Of all images, though, you must have images. And there is no image of the Incarnation. There's no image of my soul. For instance, if you want to, in your devotions, if you want to be devoted to the wounds of Christ, how are you going to make that more than a mere image if you have no means of transcending images? You can't. And that's, we're trapped in that. And that box, that the boob tube, as they call it in the United States, the boob tube, the TV, whether it's on my wrist in a Dick Tracy watch, which it will be shortly, or on a laptop, or hanging on the wall, or wherever it is, combined with my telephone, wherever it is, it's going to limit me to here and now. It's terminal. And there's no beyond, and I miss, therefore, the transcendent word of God. And that's why the ceremonies of the Church have, in the Novus Ordo system, have become so banal. So banal.
So the Novus Ordo Mass lacks that transcendent...
That's right. That's right. There's no silence for the soul at all. It's all what you say to me and I say to you, and then we shake hands and embrace.
So it's humanistic.
That's right. It's been humanized. That's right. And that's crass, and it's materialistic, and finally gets down to self-enjoyment. It's not worship of God. That's why when you mention the Old Mass or introduce people to the Old Mass, the Roman Mass, who are only with the Novus Ordo, and some of them who used to say the Roman Mass, they get horrified because they know it's a totally different thing. It's adoration of God in silence and humility while the sacrifice is being enacted in your presence.
So you have two different ideas here, each represented by a different Mass.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they're irreconcilable. There is no reconcilable availability. And I know very good theologians in your beloved Canada and my beloved United States who are constantly trying to bridge the gap between the two, and they should know better. They should know better. We should leave them unnamed because they have very good intentions, but there's no way for it. Either the Roman Mass is reinstalled or the Mass ceases to exist and the Church ceases to exist because there will be no longer the repetition of the reenactment of Christ's sacrifice in Calvary. It will be the end. It will be the end.
So the average Catholic then just can't go to his local parish in good faith and know that he's getting something
good. He must stand back and examine everything and pester the priest and find out about what's going on. Is the mechanism working? Just as he would with his car. Lift the hood and watch the carburetor and watch everything else and find out what's wrong. Why is it not going right? Is it going right? Is it a good engine? Similarly with this. And this is your obligation today. And no angel is going to come to you and enlighten you. You're not going to have a dream with an angel instructing you. You're not going to be led by the nose. No, you have to find out. It's too important. It's your eternal salvation. And the souls are entrusted to you, your children, your wife, and your friends. So you have the obligation. That's the table. That's Christ's radical decision I was speaking about. He's made this radical decision that this is the way finally to test this generation, because it is, as he called his own generation, an evil and adulterous generation. Remember, they came to him and said, have you any signs to prove that you come from God? And he said, Christ was very contemptuous, you know, in his own way, when he met the people who deserve contempt. He said, you're an evil and adulterous generation. You people can look at the sunset and tell us what sort of a day is coming tomorrow. When you get up in the morning, you can read the things and say, well, today's going to be a good day. You can forecast. You can read the signs in the heavens. And you can't read the signs now. You can't see the end is coming. You can't see the signs of my miracles. And you can't read that. And he said, then an evil and adulterous generation are going to have only one sign, Jonah in the whale's belly. And they didn't understand that. Similarly, with this generation here, we can predict everything. We can predict the weather weeks ahead of time. We can predict the market. We can predict the birth of a child. We can predict financial changes. We can predict political changes. But we do not read what God is doing with the world at the present moment. And consequently, we can't read what's happening to the churchmen and what they're doing to us. And if we continue on like that, lazy, refusing to face it because it's troublesome, God has no mercy on that. Why should he? He doesn't owe us anything. He doesn't owe you anything. Not even to save you.
What is going on in the seminaries? That's another very important question.
Well, the seminaries have been the root of great difficulty because, you see, the first of all, the teaching of theology is no longer supervised. We have, for instance, in Catholic University of Washington, we have people who don't believe Christ was God, who don't believe he rose from the dead. Why are they even allowed to exist? In the university, it is a seminary, and similarly with other seminaries throughout the country, and throughout Canada and throughout Europe itself. I'm often consulted by young men who want to become a priest and really do, and they ask me where to go to. And I have only three places in the world that I can recommend them to, and the fact is, you can rely on very few seminaries to give them normal Catholic doctrine, apart from corruption, moral corruption, because now we have the difficulty in our seminaries that homosexuality is attracting homosexuals to our seminaries. After all, they're going to live with men, and they're going to have a job with men. And I'm not saying I'm giving any moral judgment on them. You know my moral judgment on homosexuality as an active way of life. But de facto, we are attracting homosexuals. And when you go to a normal seminary in the United States, or when you apply to them after high school, and they put you through your paces, find out, are you academically capable, and are you a Catholic, and that sort of business. One of the questions asked you is, what do you think of homosexuality? And if you condemn it, in most seminaries you won't be admitted, because they will say you're not pastorally sensitive. So it's homosexuality is a problem in our seminaries, and it's also a problem in our clergy, and we mustn't exaggerate. Not every priest is a homosexual. Not even one half of the priests are. There are 55,000 priests working in the dioceses, besides, 302 bishops. But there's a solid wedge, a solid network that protect each other. That's there for certain. And certainly in the seminaries, we have trouble. We have much trouble.
Now, if we have that situation in the seminaries where the faith is not being perpetuated, are we perhaps in a situation, I think it's a tough question that we have to face, are we in a situation then, like perhaps the French Revolution, where priests are going to have to be trained underground?
Well, Bernard, the answer to that is we are training them already underground. There are priests being ordained underground by bishops, underground. Bishops who normally fit into the normal hierarchy, both in the States and Canada and in Europe, and abroad in Latin America. But that's all part of the present church being created. And it won't come out of there for a long, long time. But they are being created. And then there are rider priests, priests that go around to various places consecrating the Blessed Sacrament, saying Mass, hearing confessions, and go on, like in penal times when priests were persecuted in England and Ireland and in France and in Germany. So there are underground priests. Yes, that is taking place. And slowly but surely, parishes will be eliminated, and parish priests and ordinary diocesan clergy will be eliminated. And there's going to be a new system, but that will be long after I'm dead and long after you are gone too, probably. Unless Our Lady comes in the meantime, as the Pope is always waiting for, and from her sky comes and tells us all what to do and saves us from the errors that she has said she will save us from. But that's a hope. Until it takes place, we can't say it's going to take place.
And in the meantime, we just have to continue quietly practicing our faith the best that we know how.
Yes, but with a special effort. You just can't know, because it's handed out in the parish church, because the priest says so. You cannot accept that.
We might have to search for it then.
Yeah. You've got to send back and say, is that true? And then consult a book and talk to others and find out. You have to educate yourself, because there's no way out of it. We are faced with either ignorant priests, bad priests, negligent priests, unordained priests, stupid priests, careless priests, feckless priests. We also have good priests and good bishops, but they're in a minority. They're in a minority. And most of them will not admit the trouble we are in. That's the difficulty. Now, the question of seminaries, though, leads us on to Rome again. Rome. Why doesn't Rome do something about that? Well, the same thing happens again. We're now in the church of the hubs, the church of these various systems that are in each region and in each diocese. And they're independent. And they will not tolerate any interference from Rome. And nobody checks with Rome about a bishop's, about a professor's doctrine. Nothing takes place. Or if it does, he has friends in Rome that say he's perfectly all right. He's in good standing. He has his degree from Rome or from Washington or from some university or some seminary. And they cover and they protect him because they share his views. We have to admit this one. It's very hard, again, for the very solid Catholic. It's very hard to admit that heresy and disbelief has spread amongst the clergy, amongst the bishops, amongst the administrators of the church. You can't trust them. You can't trust them. Any longer you cannot trust them. You've got to find out what they hold and then compare with what they should hold. And you'll find there's a great difference. They're very disparate at times. And you cannot rely upon them. Then what do? Normally you walk away, because if you try to confront them, they'll tell you you're just a lay person. I'm a priest. I'm a bishop. I'm a theologian. I teach in the seminary. I know. You don't know. And it's pride, of course. They won't admit it. And having lost their belief, they're not going to. They don't know they've lost their belief. They think you're just being a stupid, perky, busybody who should be sat upon. So that's the difficulty about the seminaries. And the great sign of corruption, Father Peter Canisius, the Jesuit, the saint, said, was when he went back to Germany and Austria to try to reconvert them, was the seminaries. They were so corrupt, there was no way. They had to be wiped out. And that is what comes and brings us back to John Paul II. He can't touch them. He can't get to them. He's simply got to let them liquidate themselves one way or the other.
So we're in a situation now where the church structure, so to speak, will have to die and be resurrected.
That's right. Die out. And, for instance, there are things happening which we can never reform. For instance, in the Diocese of Pittsburgh, Archbishop Worrell is closing 68 churches. And liquidating the churches and selling off the land to non-Catholics to a large degree. They will never be restored again. It's all over. So something else is going to come, and we can discuss that, what is coming, because we know, we can see very certain outlines of what is coming, but it's going to be very different, and it'll be purged. But that takes time.
And in the next interview, we'll be discussing the age that is coming.
That's
Thank you, Malachi Martin.
Thank you, Bernard.